Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the October 15, 2024 regular session of the Island County Board of Health. Is there a motion to approve the agenda as presented?
I'll make a motion to approve the modified agenda.
Modified agenda. So let's clarify, is the agenda itself changed or is it just that we have a presentation? So the agenda is still the same?
Okay, still. I'll take that back. Okay. Make a motion to approve the agenda.
Excellent.
Second.
Motion made and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any changes to the September 17th, 2024 regular session minutes?
Make a motion to approve.
Second.
All in favor? Aye. Thank you. So this is the time that we hold for public input or comment. The board values the public's input. This time is set aside to hear from the public on subjects of a health-related nature that are not on our scheduled agenda. All information given is taken under advisement. Unless emergent in nature, no action will be taken. To ensure proper recording of comments, please state your name and address clearly into the microphone, which I don't see it sitting there, but we'll wait and see if we have any public comment and then we'll worry about it. Limit your comment to 2 minutes, and the board may entertain public comment on specific agenda items when we discussed, we'll see. So is there anyone in the public here in the room who wants to address the Board of Health? No? Okay. Anyone online who wishes to address the Board of Health? Scrolling down to see if we have any hands raised, and we do not seem to. So I'm going to close. Oh, we have one. Oh, Lori from Southwest Cares raised her hand. So yes, Lori, please.
Hi, this is Lori Johnson with the Southwood Bee Cares Coalition, and I'm in Langley. And this weekend on October 19th is the Fall Festival Cider Press, which holds the drug take back, which we now call the safe disposal event. So we'll be there from 11 to 2, accepting unused and expired prescription medication, which includes pet medication.
Okay. Accepting medication. And it says fall, you said Fall Festival, Cider Fest, Langley. Where exactly in Langley?
We'll be at the community center in the rear of the building on the lower field. Also known as like behind the cooler, if you've lived here a long time.
Okay. All right. Thank you very, very much, Lori. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Anyone else for public comment? All right, then we're going to close public comment. Thank you. And we're going to turn it over to the presentation of an overview of the voluntary garden ad litem, the VGAL program. Cheryl Duncan is going to present. VGAL.
Good afternoon. My name is Cheryl Duncan. I am the program coordinator for the Island County Volunteer Guardian Ad Litem Program. I've been in this position since the Monday after Thanksgiving, so almost a year. A little bit about my background. I was an attorney, and then I also worked in the education field, and I also worked in the nonprofit field, and so take all of that and put it together. And I think it really gave me the skills I needed for this job. Okay, whoops, went too far. Wrong direction, sorry about that. Previous, yeah. I'm going the wrong, sorry, no. I went to the end of that. That was a short presentation, wasn't it? No. There we go. All right, so dependency in Island County by the numbers, I've got just a little chart. We currently have 25 children, either in shelter care or dependency in Island County. That number actually is going up by a couple this week. And what that means is these children are placed out of home because due to abuse or neglect. And we'll talk about what that means. But these are children that are wards of the state, basically. What happens is when they're removed from home, there must be a petition filed in Superior Court. Our Superior Court, we have a dependency docket, and that is done within 72 hours of being out of home. You have to have your hearing. We right now have 12 volunteers, and they represent 23 children. Two of our children are over 12, and so they have attorneys. And we would like to have a guardian for them too, but we just don't have the people right now. But we feel pretty good that we have representation for, you know, 23 out of 25, because maybe like within this year, we were maybe, we had only about 60%. So we're doing better. We've had more training. We've got more VGALs on board. So that, but 100% is what we want. We'd like to see 25 kids have guardians, but we're doing pretty well. In 2023, we had a total of 34 children. So here we are, October, we're at 25, 26, 27, something like that. So our numbers are on par, maybe a little bit less than last year. Like I said, it's a specialized docket of the Island County Superior Court. And just to let you know, as of mid-year, about 5,000 children in Washington State are out of home. So, you know, our numbers are not that big, but every kid is, you know, still every case has to be treated like it's the most important case. So Pierce County, for instance, I think they have 3,000 kids a year come through their system. So they have paid guardians. They have staff who also, like I do, are the administrators for the volunteers. So they have a little bit of everything there. King County too. I mean, there's, so ours is small, but you know, the cases are just as important as any big. In terms of, if you look, six of those children are placed in foster homes in county. 19 are out of Island County. And I think later I'll talk a little bit about this. There's a real dearth of foster homes in Island County. We only have, I think, 9, and only 2 at any time about are accepting children. So that means our kids are sent Skagit, Whatcom, and sometimes even Yakima, depending on what their needs are. And 10 out of our 25 kids are with family or fictive kin, which is someone close to the family that they've known their whole life. So it's not like they're going with strangers. So foster care looks a little different now because there is an emphasis on keeping the children with their family. Everything shows, all studies show kids are with their families, family of origin, they do better. So there is always a search for family members in state or out of state. It takes longer if they're out of state, but anyway, yeah. Right. Computer's different than mine. Oh yeah. Did I go too many? No. All right. So why are children moved from their home? I mean, the short answer is abuse or neglect, but it's not just any abuse or neglect. There's a new standard. You probably might've heard of the Keeping Families Together Act from 2023, I think July of 2023. Children are moved only where there is an imminent safety threat to the child. And there has to be a causal relationship between the safety threat and the imminent physical harm. So the old standard was sort of if there was a chance of physical harm. So now it has to be imminent physical harm. Things that do not qualify on their own, I've got a list there, poverty, inadequate housing, substance abuse, mental illness, disability of the parent, or non-conforming social behavior. Those on their own, sometimes in the past, depending on the circumstances, would justify removal, but that is no longer the way it is. You have to show a causal connection to the danger. We have a new Senate Bill 6109, which is modifying the above, because now if there's high potency opioids in the home, that is given higher weight for removal. But they're still coming up with guidelines on that. DCYF is coming up with guidelines on that. So I'm not sure how that's going to change things. But the presence of drugs alone in the home, unless it is connected to actual imminent danger to the child, is not enough for removal.
Because being raised by a drug addicted, mentally ill, homeless mother is safe.
If that mother has a support system around them,
it's bullshit. Don't bother making an excuse for
it. Oh, well,
Drug-addicted, mentally ill mother who doesn't take care of their child is not safe or effective, and the state should remove the kid.
I think as a practical matter, they do.
Where's Janet? Can somebody get Janet over here to do her job so we can have a quorum? I need to leave. Oh. Get Janet. Pick up the phone, call Commissioner Sinclair, and say, do your job. We take a break and go to the next presentation, please.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. I'm sorry. You can come back to this, but I can't do it. I can't do it.
It's okay, Joe. Yeah, we're on break. Good. We're going to continue with this meeting. We don't have quorum, but we don't have any more decisions that we need to make. So we're going to move next to the communications update, and we will return to the VGAL presentation towards the end. If Janet gets here, if Janet doesn't get here, we'll do it at the end also anyway. So it's an important presentation. We'll get to that. So communications update. Taylor, Cecily, and Melissa.
Good afternoon, members of the board. For the record, my name is Melissa Overbury-Howland. I'm usually the clerk of the board. Today, I am before you as the office lead for Island County Public Health. And I'm joined today by Cecily Doyle, who is the president of Blueprint Agencies, agency that we have partnered with for our communications. One of the things that we just wanted to set the scene to start with as to why we want to come to you and explain a little bit about what we've done for our communications, the why behind we even are involved in communications as part of the public health agency. As of 2024, over 70% of the US population regularly use some form of social media. And what's really interesting is that 81%, this goes up to 81% for ages of 49 and under, but it actually goes up to 45% for ages 65 and over. And that number is only supposed to increase by 3 to 5% every year. And I would like to have that in the back of our minds as we go through this as to why we're pooling resources into specifically social media when we think of communications in public health. So where does this kind of fit in with some of the things that we do as a public health agency? Essentially, this is part of the 10 essentials of public health services. It's right here. It's the communicate effectively to inform and educate. Okay, so that's, we are obligated as a local health jurisdiction, we are obligated to do this. And one of the things that social media does is that it essentially allows us to engage with our community. It's not just getting the information out there, it's ensuring that the information is sticking. It's actually getting to the places that it needs to get to. And some of the ways that we do this, we need to make sure that it's effective. We need to make sure that it's timely. And I'll come and explain a little bit about what we're doing for that and with Cecily's help. We want to make it accessible. And by accessible, I mean in the sense that it's not just going out and just text. There's different formats that we're trying to use, that we're experimenting with. We want to make sure that everyone can access this, whether you're sort of, you know, a young teen all the way up to, you know, 64, 65 and older, and wanting to understand what public health is doing and some of the services that we provide. We want to make sure that it's engaging. We've been trying very hard to, thankfully with Cecily's help, to ensure that we are an agency that people can trust. We've really tried to foster this sense that, you know, we hear you, these are the resources, these are the trusted resources, from a variety of places. And at the end of the day, we're trying to keep it varied. Again, it helps that engagement, but the varied aspect also helps with maintaining a sense of relationship. It's not just block text time and time again. I really liked this quote from Boston University that kind of ties it all together. To be effective and more equitable, something that we are definitely trying very hard nowadays to approach, public health communication efforts need to be responsive to the dynamic and evolving nature of the digital environment, including different online behaviors, not everyone approaches things in the same way, and social media use patterns of diverse demographic groups. And I'm hoping that by the end of today's presentation, you'll get a sense of how we're trying to address that. So some of the things that we've already been doing, it's not like we haven't been doing communications before, but we have been trying to improve our communications. So for example, we've been working again with Blueprint agencies to bring out some, a little bit more of a fresh feel to some of our publications. I know that this year we actually brought this to the Board of Health, heat advisory pamphlet that sort of, you know, informed people of some of the dangers to heat and how they could keep themselves cool in the summer. That is now out with our partners. This is a printed material that can now be shared. But the other thing that we've been really focusing on is our outreach events. We've, you know, pulled some resources into making sure that we do have things to give out that are, you know, that we have a presence at local events. And just in case you didn't know who we were, we tried to make our tent very obvious as to who we are. I think it could do with a few more logos, but there you go. It's very clearly who we are. And people have, we've had some really nice interactions with the public at these events. I hope one day that we can have some of our staff come in and actually talk to you about some of the lovely conversations that people have had at these events. And we get good questions. We get genuinely good questions. And this is a key aspect of the communications of public health. We've also been working very closely with Blueprint for newsletters. So we've got a DNR newsletter going out. We've got our Health Matters, but we've also started a food service news. Again, this actually came directly from the public, from people in the food industry saying, hey, we wanted more information about what's been changing, what's been going on. And we listened. And again, with Blueprint, we were able to produce this lovely newsletter. And this is going out once or twice a year. Again, to keep people up to date with what Island County Public Health are doing for our food industry. The other thing that we've been working really hard on is revamping our web pages. We're making them a bit more accessible. They're not just block text anymore. We've been putting more infographics up on the internet so to make it a little bit easier to gather information quickly and effectively. We've also been working with Vibrand Media, who's also sitting here, Anaya over there. And I'll speak a little bit more to that, but we've been getting other languages up on the internet as well. So I believe Spanish and Tagalog as well. So we've been trying really hard to basically revamp and renew a lot of our communications that were already taking place. So where does social media fit into this? Bearing in mind that very, very first slide, social media is one of the ways in which we are able to get resources out to the public quickly, effectively, timely, and also that people flock to. So some of the things that we do already, that's our staff posting about their programs. But the reason why we needed Blueprint to come in and help is basically our staff are already really stretched in terms of the timing. And although they were able to post on their programs, it wasn't necessarily always as effective. It wasn't always as timely. And basically what Blueprint have done, they've come in and streamlined the process for us. Not only that, but they've allowed us to have an excellent platform from which we can actually plan way ahead. Cecily actually basically puts together the entire month, half of a month before that month. So everything is going out in a very timely fashion. Obviously, there are a few things that need to go out that might be posted, you know, we do on the fly. But at the end of the day, it's allowed us to really organize our social media campaign. And again, Vibrand Media have come on as they are a Spanish consultant. And so now we're getting media out there in two languages and not just one. Our main focus at the moment is Facebook, Instagram, and Nextdoor. We found that these are the most effective ones on the island, although I will say a little bit about how we're going to expand that later on. And just to give you an idea at how numbers work and how effective, like our contract has been with Blueprint. So since January 2024 alone, we have increased our followers by 30%. That's 30% more people who are now actively following Island County Public Health. And we've actually had a 26.9% increase in interactions. That's people who have liked us, who have commented on us, who have shared our posts. And again, we're seeing that going up month and month and month as we go on with our contract. What's really interesting about Instagram is we hardly had any presence on Instagram before. And Instagram is huge with the youth of today. It really is. It's one of the main platforms that younger folk do use. And we've had an increase of 145% in terms of followers. And not only that, we've also had content interactions, 705 content interactions on Facebook, on Instagram alone. These are young folk who have actually engaged with Island County Public Health. I wanted to give a little, I wanted Cecily to have just a moment because she was the one who absolutely insisted that we put this up here. And I think it's so important that we realize this.
I think that one of the challenges, especially with public health, is you're working against the misinformation that's on the internet. And we have seen 768 link clicks. And that's important because that's 768 people who accessed health information from the county. They accessed county-related resources, and they accessed evidence-based resources. So
through us. So that'll be clicks on our links that are going up on Instagram and Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give you an idea of some of the posts and how far they reach. So for example, one of the things that we often post on are things like any closure alert. So this, for example, is one of the posts that we have. This is through Matt Farr, our environmental health specialist who deals with any biotoxin closure alerts. These are done as timely as possible, sometimes quite late in the day. It'll be a case of, okay, we need to get this out quickly. And again, this is, a way of just protecting the public, of getting it out there as quickly as possible. But the nice thing is that Cecily has provided us the templates for this. So again, we're not spending time. How are we going to get this out there? I don't have the time to do this. The template's already there. We pop in the information. It's out timely. And just to give you an idea, this one single post reached 12,574 people. That's 12,574 people that read that post and knew, okay, I can't go and do selfish collecting in this particular location today. Another thing that we had this summer, for example, just this August, we gave an update on the seagull issue at Oak Harbor Safeway. Sometimes it's just a case of keeping the public updated so that people do feel that they can understand what's going on. And just to give you an idea, that reach was over 13,000 people read that. And we actually, as you can see there, we had a lot of engagement. 92 people either clicked on it and loved it. And we had 32 people actively talking about this. Like, hey, have you seen this? What are we gonna do about it? Or, it's just a chance for the community to come together and actually have a conversation with us. It's a great tool. Again, another thing that we had, another popular post was when we had the bat test positive for rabies on Whidbey Island, and we were able to post this really quickly up in terms of, okay, these are the precautions that you can take, because not everyone will know these precautions. Mm-hmm. A lot of the times it's just getting something very simple, very quickly out there so that, again, it's a way of calming fear. It's also a way of educating, that inform and educate piece. And again, that was about 11,000, just over 11,000 people who saw this or in some ways engaged with this post. So we are getting traction on a lot of our things on social media. I wanted to give a lovely example that was actually quite recent. This went out just this month. This was for our New Baby, New Family support group. It's a wonderful little program. It's once a week, people can come together and it's for anyone who needs postpartum support. And we actually had someone who said, hey, would you please consider offering this on Kameno too? Now we had actually posted about a month or two ago that we did actually have one of these on Kameno as well. And it was just a lovely moment where we were able to reach out to this individual and say, hey, there is already a Kameno group. It's on this date, and I'm so glad you asked. And again, if that hadn't been there, that person might not have realized that they could have accessed that on Kameno as well. We had another person ask, hey, can you offer something like that for postpartum moms who have lost their babies? This is direct communication with the public. And again, we were able to say, absolutely, you are 100% welcome to come to these groups. But if you would like, we can do a one-to-one with our nurses if this individual needs support. And that was a direct link from one of our nurses in our community health division with this mom who might need that support now. I'm just trying to give you some examples of how our social media presence is making direct impacts on people in the public. Another thing that we've been doing, like I said, we have started a focus, not a started, but we've been trying to have a focus on equity. And part of that is by partnering with our Spanish consultant, Anai, from Vibran Media. And so now what we've been doing is together with Cecily, we're now producing infographics, not only in English, but in Spanish. Again, that's that quick way of getting information out to the people that need it in a way that is accessible to them, to more than one demographic. A nice little thing from Nextdoor, I thought. I wanted to show this, that a community celebrating. So this was more of a celebration rather than informing. This is when Island County Public Health WIC team received the Breastfeeding Award for Excellence. And again, we just wanted to celebrate and share this. But what was nice was the outpouring of goodwill and good love that came from Nextdoor. And we had so many people just write in, hearting everything, saying, this is fantastic news. And it's just another way of showing how social media can bring community together. I know that social media tends to get a very bad rap sometimes, but there are lovely times as well when the community really shows its support. So why expand it at all? Like, okay, we're doing well, but why expand it at all? And I just wanted to give you an idea. The average social media user has accounts on 6.6 different platforms. That seems crazy, but that doesn't mean everyone is using all of those platforms all at once. Usually it just means that they have an account and they're trying out which one they are. And that number is only supposed to grow. To give you an idea, these are some of the most popular ones that, and you can see they're all, most of them going up. The main one being YouTube. And I want to talk a little bit about why YouTube is going up so high, why it's still high. Obviously, Facebook is up there as well. But as you can see, TikTok is starting to really creep up there. Again, are we noticing a trend here? YouTube videos, TikTok videos. And the other one that is really creeping up there is WhatsApp. We are not venturing into the YouTube or TikTok sphere, but we are looking into WhatsApp. We do have plans to expand onto WhatsApp, and I'll explain a little bit about why we're going to do that. But the key thing in here to take away from here is the video content. People relate to video content, and we're seeing that even more so with across the board in terms of ages. This is interesting. In terms of health-related uses of social media, so this is not social media in general, this is just health-related uses of social media. The most popular activity was watching health-related YouTube videos.
Hmm.
Yeah, and what was interesting about that is that followed on by sharing this health information on social networking sites. So people are sharing the videos that they are watching when they're coming to look for information about health. So what are we doing? Well, basically, together with Blueprint, we are expanding our popular and upcoming apps. We're basically creating more video content. In fact, Sassy's been amazing, and she just sent me 4 video clips all at once for just this month alone. She's been, creating templates for us to literally plug and play to create video content ourselves as well. And these have been going up, and they've been getting traction, and they've been sharing. We've seen a lot of shares for some of these videos, some of this video content. And again, I mentioned WhatsApp, and in some ways, this is where Vibran Media comes in. So WhatsApp is interesting because it's very heavily used by Latino communities. And I think that's partially because it does have a wonderful way of connecting across countries. WhatsApp is tend to be used quite sort of globally as opposed to just in America. And so one of the things that we're looking into is creating an Island County WhatsApp channel, It works a bit like Twitter. You can't interact on it. You can only share the material, or you can like it, but you can't have that interaction. But it's basically like a broadcast channel. Mm-hmm. And we're hoping to have that entirely in Spanish.
Oh,
specific to Island County. Great. So it's a way for our Hispanic community to get timely information specifically in Spanish on the app that they are most likely to find it on.
Great.
Another thing that we are doing, we're also doing plug and play templates. These can be used by staff for easy material publication. And we are also completing a complete website audit. So again, with Cecily's help, we're going through the entire website and basically making it easier to navigate. We in Island County Public Health know where to look for a majority of the stuff on our website, but we've discovered that that might not always be the case for members of the public. They do get lost on our website a little bit, and Cecily's been helping us basically streamline the website to make it a little bit more manageable and navigable. Finally, another thing that we're very excited to discuss with you today is we are also putting together a resource, a public health and human services resource navigator specific to Island County that you'll be able to filter. But depending on your geographic location in Island County, this will be basically like a resource hub, but it'll be more directed towards, hey, if you have a question but you don't know what resource you're looking for, because it's mm-hmm. one thing to have it all listed, but maybe some people might not know what they need to look for. So one of the things that we're doing is we're producing a web-based app to help people find the resources they need by coming to us with a problem or with a question, rather than necessarily coming to us looking and not knowing exactly what resources they might need.
Okay, so this is our own app you're talking about?
Yes, we're producing it with, again, with Blueprint, and we're hoping to bring that to you in 2025 with a, you know, a full-baked idea.
Okay,
but this look is forward just in to its it. Infancy. Yeah, we just had a look at it today, and it is absolutely gorgeous. It looks stunning. We're just tweaking it here and there, and we're very excited to let you know that this is in the works, and we're looking forward to bringing it to Board of Health. I think I would just like to take this moment to ask my colleagues if there was anything else you wanted to add, and also to have any questions.
No, I. So do you belong to 6.6 social media applications?
I don't think I even own a cell phone, do I?
Yeah.
Very informative. You did a great job.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. No. This is exciting, and I'm I can see that you're enthusiastic about it, and that's wonderful.
I just want to take a moment to thank both Cecily and I. It's been an absolute pleasure working with them. We couldn't have contracted with two of the most, like, they're just the most amazing people to work with. Incredibly easy, have been so responsive. So I just want to say on record, thank you very much for contracting with us.
I want to say on the record that this community is wonderful, and working with you guys is a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Okay, I think we're going to go back to finish the VGAL presentation. Let's get that. Let's go back to that. And you were on.
And we thank you for being very patient.
Yeah, we do appreciate it. You were on page 3 of the slides about why children are removed from their home.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you.
Can you have them removed when they're 30 years old?
18 and under. I know, sometimes they cause trouble after that. Oh. Thank you. All right. And I was talking about that you have to have imminent safety threat, but not only must there be an imminent safety threat, it must outweigh the harm to the child by being removed. Study after study shows that children, no matter what you think about how their parents are raising them, they want to be with their parents. And we see this with our kids because that's their parent, right? And they don't know a different life. The Keeping Families Together Act is
was enacted because there was an overrepresentation of children of color in the system. And it was an acknowledgement of the fact that there is trauma to taking the child out of the home. So they do a lot before a dependency is filed. They try to support the parents through voluntary placement agreements. Maybe the child can go stay with the grandparents while they try to get the parents the help they need. So the Department of Children, Youth and Families, they do a lot of things before that petition is filed to try to keep the family together.
So what about in the situations where there's lots of drugs in the house, they're neglectful parents, they're abusive parents, they're, you know, mean to the kids and spanking the kids, but there's not this level of imminent danger to the child. Are people working with those families?
Usually, I would say yes. I mean, the complaints come in through to the Child Protective Services and they investigate. And if there is an imminent threat, they will remove the child right away. But if it is a question of, you know, is the house, there's levels of things that can go on. And they make the determination whether they can help this family and get them back on their feet. Mm-hmm. It's usually most of our cases are substance use disorder cases. And if you can get those parents into treatment and get them back on their feet, they can be really good parents. And we do have happy endings where they do go back. Yeah. So if we can do that, but the ones that do make it into, you know, into dependency court, they are serious cases. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's easy to try to imagine a case but the fact of the matter is when there is substance use abuse going on in a home, oftentimes it does result in removal. Because if the parent doesn't get help, they are incapable of taking care of the child. So there is neglect. The child is not fed. The child is not clean. The child does not go to school. Mm-hmm. Physical abuse, that's imminent threat, right? We don't see a whole lot of that. It's more neglect, actually. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say, you know, it's a case-by-case thing. And there's hard decisions that the Department of Children, Youth, and Families have to make. We don't see any of that. We are not involved until the actual dependency is filed. Sure. And at that point, it's pretty clear that something needs to be done, that we're already past that part. This is more just background for you to see that the law has changed and fewer children are in dependency now. And I have the number on the next slide, I believe. But yeah, they aren't just, it's a little bit, it's the standard's a lot higher to move children, but the department feels that it is getting the real dangerous ones. And then they do try to help. Sometimes it doesn't work out and they end up filing a petition anyway, but there is an attempt to try to keep the family together, recognizing how important it is for children to be with their families.
I mean, you're not responsible for this.
Oh no.
But, it may be very traumatic to take children away from their parents. It's also traumatic for a child to be raised in a neglectful and abusive home. And at least if you take them away from the parents, then it's a safer, you're going to be putting them in a safer situation. So you're doing that. I would hope that this is a state law, correct? I would hope that the state continues to assess the value of this and whether or not this was the right decision to make this change and how we manage this.
Yes, I would agree. I think that filings of dependency petitions are down, but I think that on its own doesn't tell you anything. Mm-hmm. Because are the children safe is what you want to know.
Right.
But I think that they point to the fact that they are able to get families stabilized without filing a petition many times. So I think that that is why filings are down. You know, once reports are made to CPS, they're under an obligation to see it through one way or the other, either stabilize that family or file for the dependency. So, you know, hopefully not too many things fall through the cracks. I think remains to be seen. The law is only
ever get the drug and alcohol rehab centers, which we're all hurting for.
Yes.
that would have like a huge impact probably on your numbers, because like you said, that's the primary thing.
Yes, yes.
And you don't want to see a child in a home where all of a sudden there's opioids or whatever laying around.
Right.
You know, that, like I said, the treatment centers, like what you're talking about, goes hand in hand with the fact we need treatment centers to help you out.
We absolutely do. We absolutely do.
That needs to be a priority.
Yes. So yeah, real quick, step one is that CPS investigation. They received 92,000 calls in 2023.
Do you know how many of those 92,000 calls were Island County calls?
No, I don't know that. That's a good question. I can find that out. The dependency petition will be filed in Superior Court, or families can enter into that voluntary placement agreement where they agree to have their kids go stay with grandma or even a foster family while they get help. So people do that. You can do a couple of those for a total of 180 days. So that does happen, but a lot of our cases come from there in that the parents could not, you know, remedy the parental deficiencies in that 180 days. So then once the petition is filed, it goes to shelter care hearing. You have to have the first shelter care hearing within 72 hours of the petition being filed. And then every 30 days thereafter, the child is not in dependency at that point. You have a trial for dependency, or the parents often will enter into an agreed order of dependency. That's to be done in 75 days from the time the child's been removed from the home. And then if in 15 months or so, the parents are not getting better, they are not trying to remedy their parental deficiencies, there's a decision on permanency to be made. Should the parental rights be terminated, or should the child enter into a guardianship with a family member, usually, but it could be someone they're close to, that, you know, fictive kin. So yeah. So that's, and then once the parental rights are terminated, and the child is adopted, the case is over. For guardianship, you don't need to terminate parental rights. The parents still have rights in the guardianship. They just don't have custody and control. But so guardianship's a little different. So what does our volunteer guardians do? What are they? They're a specially trained citizen appointed by the juvenile court judge to represent the child removed from the home where there's been cases of abuse and neglect. And their role is to present the court with an informed and objective perspective regarding what is in the best interest of the child. Some have called them the eyes and ears of the court. Our program is part of the juvenile court services. We're located right underneath the juvenile jail. It's been a program since 1987, and you might have heard it referred to as the CASA program. It used to be the CASA program, which stands for Court Appointed Special Advocates. The CASA program came about in 1976 when the Judge David Zukup at King County, realized that he was in dependency court, and he realized that although there were social workers involved, there was no one really speaking just for the best interest of the child. So he came up with this idea of having guardians appointed to them. And he said that judges need CASA volunteers in their courts, because there's no one else in that courtroom whose only function is to address the child's needs. Everyone else has some other role. So that's what our VGALs do. We used to have the CASA program, but we no longer do. We're part of the Washington Association of Child Advocate Programs. That's our governing body. And they represent both CASA and VGAL, because some counties still in Washington still have CASA. Overall, there's 1,500 volunteers in either CASA or VGAL, representing almost 5,000 children in the state. So it's a big program. What's the difference between a CASA and a VGAL? No difference. It's a copyright thing, I think, you know, I'm not exactly sure. So what do our VGALs do? Once they are assigned to a child, they will investigate. They will talk to the child at least once a month. If it's a baby, you still visit, because a baby can tell you all kinds of things just by watching it. meet with the caregivers. Sometimes these are foster parents. Sometimes they're grandmas. Sometimes they're aunts, whoever's has that child. You meet with the parents. Not always easy to do. The parents are often unavailable. It's hard to get them, but we try to have them talk to the parents and about, you know, but the parent is the best source of information on their child. And so you need to talk to the parent about that child and their likes and dislikes and talents and strengths and needs. If they're in school, you meet with teachers, family members, you review their medical and therapeutic records, and you attend meetings involving the child, whether that is a DCYF meeting or a school IEP meeting. So they're there for the kids. Then what do you do with all this information? You recommend a course of action to the court. Such things as how often should the child meet with the parent? It's the law that the child gets to meet with the parent. Their visitation. I mean, it might be monitored visitation, it might be supervised visitation, but that is up to the VGAL and the department to come up with what's best for the child for visitation. What services does the child need? Do they need counseling? Let's just put it this way. Almost every single one of them do need some type of counseling. Do they need occupational therapy? Based on the records, what do you recommend? What services do the parents need? We don't usually make a lot of parent recommendations. That's more the DCYFs, but you know, sometimes our VGALs might know of a program that might work for the parent that the social worker isn't familiar with. It happens. And where should the big question, where should the child be placed permanently? And also, where is the child in a good place now? So those are pretty big. The biggest issue I think our VGALs deal with is what should be the plan for the child? Should the parents' rights be terminated? Should the child be adopted? Should the child do guardianship? And that's you have the child's life in your hands at that point. So you need to make the right decision based on all of the information. What else do they do? They facilitate the resolution. They're trained to be familiar with programs for the children and parents, and they can weigh in on some of those issues. They can ask the court to take action on behalf of the child. Our VGALs can file motions through our office, and that happens sometimes. Since I've been here, we've done it once, and we didn't agree with the department as to what should happen, and it was going to happen. And so we went and asked the court to do something else. And then the court agreed with us. So that's something they can do. Also, like I said, the VGAL monitors progress towards establishing permanency for the child. Reunification with a parent is always the number one goal for the first few months of a case, for at least the first 6 months. Because like I said, the studies show that families that stay together, that is better for the children in the long term. The main question, can the child be returned home without imminent safety threat? So if that answer is no, then the child has to stay out of home. If the parent has done what they need to get healthy, then they have what's called a trial return home. And the VGAL will weigh in on that, and what should the conditions be, and what should the safety framework be of that trial return home. So that can happen. Things that are not to be considered in deciding whether reunification is proper, the financial resources of the parents versus the financial resources of the caregivers. We do not just make a determination, oh, we think they would have a better life over there with these foster parents because the parents don't have financial needs. No, that is not a decision. That's an invalid grounds for recommending adoption over reunification. Mm-hmm. Also, the fact that the parents may not have a home is not grounds because they need to work on getting that home. The department does. So that is also not grounds for not returning children. That can be remedied. Or the idea that the parents are not going to give them as stable of a life as the foster parents or the caregivers. That is not a valid ground. The reunification, if the parents are not an imminent safety threat and have done what they need to do to resolve their parental deficiencies, you want to reunite those children. I think that's, I think some people think maybe the VGALs can say, well, they, you know, the foster family seems more stable, can give them more in the long run. In the long run, they will be better in their own families because kids want to go back to their own families. If reunification is not available because the parents' inability to remedy those deficiencies, there's two decisions, whether adoption or Title 13 guardianship. And it used to be people really didn't like guardianship because the benefits for adoption were more, but the state, the Department of Children, Youth and Families, it's now kind of equal, the benefits that you can get, support benefits, they're kind of equal now. So it just depends on what the family that's either adopting or doing guardianship prefers. Adoption is permanent. I mean, that is your child. They get a new birth certificate. They get a new name if you prefer. In order to have that, the parental rights must be terminated in a trial, or many parents will voluntarily relinquish it. If they, especially if they can have an open adoption where they can see the child a couple times a year, send birthday cards, send Christmas cards. So a lot of the parents, we always prefer the open adoption because it's just better for everybody. But after adoption, a child is a legal part of the new family and the parents' rights are extinguished. Title 13 guardianship, it's usually by someone that the child has known their whole life. Doesn't have to be. You can also be go into guardianship with foster parent or with your foster parents. The parental rights are not terminated, just physical custody and the rights to make decisions for the child rests with the guardian. And it ends when the child's 18. And a guardianship can be undone by a court if it's in the best interest of the child and all parties agree. So sometimes guardianship works, say a parent isn't quite healthy, working on it, but you know, 15 months isn't long enough. The grandparents will often do the guardianship, and then the mom or the dad is still in the child's life. And then if they do get healthy, they can ask the court, and if all agree, they can ask the court to undo the guardianship. So that works for that kind of situation. And how does the VGAL let the court know? They attend all the hearings involving the child. They're in our dependency court right across the street, 9:30 every Thursday morning. Like I said, the VGAL may have to file a motion on behalf of the child. And they also have to file their report. Whatever the hearing is, if it's a permanency hearing, you have to file a report. There's different types of hearings, and our VGALs do generate their reports. They're not very long, 3 to 4 pages. Mm-hmm. And there can also be a fact-finding trial, and sometimes our VGALs, and that will be as to whether dependency is proper. And so our VGALs can be witnesses in those. They're always witnesses in those, I should say, or in a termination trial, our VGALs can be witnesses there too. So they can file reports and they can be witnesses. They differ from social workers. Social workers have dozens of cases. Our VGALs have one or two. We generally don't allow our VGALs to have more than two families. Social worker has to consider the interests of not just the child. They have to consider department policy, what's good for the family, as well as the child. And the VGALs, they aren't, you know, they don't have any of those policies binding them. They don't replace a social worker, but is an independent appointee of the court. Also, attorneys, if a child is 12 or older, they get an attorney appointed, and you can also get one younger than that under special circumstances. But an attorney has to do what the client wants them to do. The attorney is directed by the client. Whether or not that's in the client's best interest, the attorney will try to tell the client that that is not in your best interest, but it is the client's call. The VGAL is always going for the child's best interest. Sometimes it's not what the child wants. It might be, it might not be. And there's also guardian ad litem and divorce cases. That is not the same thing. That is, we don't do that kind of work. That's just something different. They weigh in on custody and things like that. That's not what we do. What's required to become a VGAL? No special skills. You just have to be 21 years old and must make a, we ask for a minimum commitment of 2 years to the child, because these kids have so many people in and out of their lives. And sometimes the VGAL is one of the longest lasting adults in their life. What training is required? We do, they're required to do 30 hours of training with the state group. And then I do the local training. It's about 8 to 10 hours. And they have to pass background checks, of course, every year, including fingerprinting. And then they have to do 12 hours of continuing education in during the year. They aren't really on their own. I have the best job in the world. I always say I'm the program coordinator. So I go to court with them. I help them with the reports. I talk through issues. Sometimes I'm just there to listen. This is really heavy stuff. We find out really horrible things sometimes, and sometimes they just need to vent. The VGAL is basically takes in information but doesn't give it out except for in court reports. There we hold confidentiality very seriously, so they really can't talk to their family about the matter. They can't talk to their friends about the matter, but they can pick up the phone and talk to me, and I can listen, come up with ideas. We take their self-care very seriously, because secondhand trauma is a real thing. And so we do offer all kinds of ways for them to deal with some of that. And they can also use, they are volunteers for Island County, so they can use the EAP if they need to. And we have had them do that. So anyway, I'm kind of just there. You know, so we have 25 cases right now. Like, I know what's going on every single one of those cases, but I think good. I do not have to interview people. I don't do any of the actual legwork. That's why I say I have the best job, because I know what's going on in all the cases, but I just, you know, just from reading it and talking to my VGALs.
So foster parents receive some compensation.
Yes.
Do VGALs receive any remuneration at all?
Oh, no. Right. Ours are all volunteer. Mm-hmm. Like I was saying, the bigger counties, they have staff GALs. But we do not. Ours are all volunteers. And they're really amazing people. I'll just put they honestly put their heart and soul into it. And it's hard work and it's heavy work. I mean, there's volunteer work and there's volunteer work, right? This isn't just a, you know, committee. Not that I'm not denigrating anybody's volunteer work, but this is something that is really very serious.
I know somebody who was interested in it at one point and went to apply. And I think the reason that he didn't go forward with it was because of risk responsibilities. Can you talk about the risk that they undertake?
You mean safety?
Legal lawsuits.
Oh, yes. No, as a court appointee, you have immunity from anything that isn't, I would say, grossly negligent. So, mm-hmm. Yeah,
okay.
I don't think that is a problem. Because we are asked that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But you do have immunity under the RCWs, and I can. If I can provide you that, I don't have it at my fingertips.
No,
but
sure.
Yes, except for criminal acts, we can't.
Oh, of course. No, of course.
right. Criminal acts, gross negligence. But if they're just doing their job, yeah. Mm. And there's some people worry about safety too, but we tell our VGALs, never go into anything you don't feel safe. You know, if you're visiting the child somewhere and you feel, you know, your senses are telling you there's something off, just excuse yourself to go out to look at your notes and then say, you know, I forgot to, you know, never put yourself in or take someone with you. Mm-hmm. So there's also that angle too. So here's the benefits that VGALs provide the children. They have better outcomes than children who do not. In that, the VGAL pushes for the outcome for the child that might not otherwise be advocated for, because social workers are very busy. And while they have their policies, they sometimes are just too busy to push for what that child needs. The kids will receive more court ordered services and are more likely to end up in a permanent home. They usually spend less time in the court system because they have somebody there pushing the case along. Sometimes they're the only consistent adult in that child's life. And that's a pretty important role. And they can explain to children what's going on in the court. And you know, these kids have questions. They don't understand the system. Who could blame them? Adults don't understand the system sometimes. So they can, you know, sort of help the child through the system, understand what the system is and what's going on. What do we need right now? We always need volunteers. We have we have 12 volunteers now and 3 in training. We always lose 1 or 2 a year due to people moving or just burnout, you know. We estimate that it's about a 12 to 15 hour job, you know, because once dependency is established, your hearings are once every 6 months. So during that 6 months, yes, you're doing your talking to your child every month. You're talking to the teachers if it's the school year. You're talking to, but it's not super heavy. But then when it's your report, you know, your report will take some time. Going to court takes time, but it's you know, 12 to 15 hours once you've been trained. And one thing we do need in our county are parent supports. We don't have a parent for parent group. That's where you have parents who have been through the system and come out on the other side, and they act as like allies and guides for these parents because it's overwhelming. You know, they're sick. They've had their child removed. It's confusing. It's scary. And so if you have these parent for parent volunteers, it's nice to have them walk alongside you, help you. So that is something we're looking to get going. And then sometimes these parents just have a hard time getting to the doctor, making those appointments. Yes, the department will give them referrals for whatever they need to get better, but getting there on time, doing it, this is all hard to do. So we need people to help with that. Foster parents, they need foster parents in our county. I think I mentioned we only have 9 homes on the island and only 2 are probably available. I don't think any are available right now. And a lot of homes say they just want infants. And so we need the specially trained foster parents. We have children who have very high behavior needs, and the foster parents that are trained in handling with those children are very valuable, and there aren't too many of them, but they're needed. So yeah, that's the, that's, I mean, I could talk about this stuff all day. I'm sorry if I took up too long, but
thank you.
Anyway,
very much.
Yeah. Anybody has questions, or, you know, I'm right over there. Right. And so if you have any questions about the program afterwards, I'm happy to, you know, talk, email, phone, whatever.
Thank you. Very informative. I didn't know that you were even existed.
Yeah. Luckily this county, doesn't have a ton of cases, but, yeah. And we do have happy endings. We do have reunifications, and adoptions are happy too, in a different way. You know, we do, you know, I think that it can be heartbreaking work. But it can also be very rewarding work. And I think for me and the VGALs, I know that you hear these terrible stories of what's happened to the child or what's going on in their life, and you just feel so bad for them. But then you see all these people, you know, the social workers, the VGAL, the counselors, you know, you'll have a meeting about one of these children, and the Zoom is just filled with people who are trying to get that child stabilized, get that child permanency, get that family back on their feet, whatever. There's so many people in the system that are give you hope. So the sad tales are, you know, hopefully not the end of it. So anyway.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Yeah, really thank you. That.
It's important work. Most important work. Okay. So winter storm readiness, Eric.
I thought we were bypassing winter.
Yeah, let's just ignore winter.
Yeah. You make it go away.
Huh? Look at you. He's prepared.
Oh my gosh, look at that.
It's over here.
Good afternoon. I'm Eric Brooks with the Ida County Department of Emergency Management. I appreciate the invitation to come speak about preparing for winter weather. So if you look outside, especially this week, we know that winter is coming and winter presents all kinds of challenges here for Island County. We know that we're going to have high winds. We know that we're going to have rain. We know that roads are going to be bad. Power is going to be out. Sooner or later, we get all that every year. Just to what degree is always a mystery for us. But there are things that we can do in order to be prepared, prepare ourselves. And a lot of those things are things that we do for all hazards. We always stress to make sure you have a kit, have your emergency kit ready, have a plan for those contingencies. And then you want to stay informed as well. So let's start off with the stay informed part and see what the forecast is for the coming months here. So we were kind of lucky the last couple of years. We had a El Nino conditions, and El Nino typically means that it's going to be a little bit warmer. It's going to be a little bit drier than what we have this year. This year, we're looking at a La Nina. So we have a La Nina watch, and granted, it's going to be a little bit of a weaker La Nina, but that just means that things could be a little bit wetter and a little bit cooler than average. So the latter part or the early part of next year is a little bit of an increase on the La Nina conditions, but we can see that here. So the first 3 months, the end of 2024, we have, as far as temperature goes, it's going to be equal chances. We could have below or above our normal temperatures. As far as precipitation goes, we're looking at above average precipitation. Chances are we'll have above average. You look at the early part of 2025, January, February, March, and that's when our chances of having below normal temperatures is going to pick up. So likely what we're going to have in January, February is cold temperatures below normal, and then we're going to have the increased precipitation. Something people always worry about is what we call the king tide. It's more accurately called the perigean spring tide. And that happens when we have a new moon or a full moon, and when the moon is closest to the Earth in its monthly orbit. So as you can see from the figure right there, it's when the sun and the moon and the Earth, or the sun and the Earth and the moon, are aligned. And what that means is it creates a little bit more of a gravitational pull, kind of a bulge in the ocean there. And what we get from that is higher than normal tides. So a lot of times we'll call it spring tides or king tides. It's known as a perigean spring tide. So this is what it looks like for this year. So the impacts of just having a regular king tide is we can get some minor coastal flooding from it. If we have atmospheric conditions that are favorable, so if we have particularly low pressure, or if we have those winds that are coming up from the water, then we can certainly get some major coastal flooding. And we experienced that a couple years ago. So the number of days of concern per month there, November, we have 7 in particular of higher concern coming up is 15 to 17 November. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. In December, we have 16 days of concern of higher concern is going to be 14, 15 December. And then January, we have 20 days, February 3, and then March, we can just kind of relax. We only have one day that we're going to be concerned about with that. So here's just some examples of what could happen during a king tide here. So we have the high tides. We get a little bit of a low pressure that can create coastal flooding as we've experienced in the past there. You add wind to that, and you can really do some damage to some houses. This one here is West Beach. So that's some waves coming off of West Beach. This was several years ago, but we experienced this not too long ago as well. It also can do some damage to the houses. So that's also West Beach there. A lot of driftwood coming across the road for that. Luckily, our Public Works Department is outstanding at clearing those quickly and bringing it up for traffic again. So this is a pretty common scene that we have during the winter months. So what do we do when you can't travel from place to place? You can't get your resources. So what we do is we build an emergency kit. And what we want in an emergency kit, you want things that you can't do without. So obviously we want our food and our water. With that food and that water, you want to make sure that it's non-perishable food, because you never know how long the power might be out around here. You want to make sure that you have something to keep warm. So have plenty of blankets, extra clothes, things like that. You see in the back there, that's a heater. That's a Mr. Heater Buddy. That's recommended for indoors. So if you do have some kind of heater, make sure it is recommended for indoors. And we'll talk about that staying warm a little bit later. Flashlights, make sure you have some source of light to get around. Make sure you have your radio, not just for entertainment, but also a lot of times that might be the only way you're getting your news is through a NOAA weather radio. So highly recommend that. Some source of entertainment. Your power's out and it's out for days. You don't want to just be staring at each other. So have some way to entertain yourself, whether it's books or games or something like that. First aid kit. You may not be able to get to a hospital, so make sure you have a first aid kit and know how to use it. And then everybody's got some kind of special needs or wants or comfort items that is going to help them get through some of the rougher parts. So make sure you have that as well. And then, of course, additional batteries, cords, and then also if you're going to use a generator. So a lot of people have built-in generators, which is great, built into the house. A lot of people use portable generators too. And if you're going to use a portable generator, make sure that you do it safely. So this is also another common sight, trees and wire. We get that quite a bit here. A lot of people want to use the generators, which is great. If it's portable, never use it inside an enclosed space. I know it seems obvious, but every year we get people that have plugged that generator in and they kept it in. If you keep it in and you have a door open and fans going, that may not be enough to keep that carbon monoxide from asphyxiating somebody. So definitely use it outdoors, place it away from any windows or vents so you don't get the exhaust in your house. Make sure you don't overload it. You want to make sure that any power that is being generated exceeds the power that you're being used. And you can easily check that through, you know, look at the label on your refrigerator or your stove or whatever you're using. And then connect it properly. We have problems every year, people connecting it straight into their wall outlet. And that might power your house, but it also backfills the system. So what that does is it creates a danger or hazard to our workmen that are trying to restore power. So never plug it into your wall. Always make sure that your generators are hooked up professionally. And then if you're going to plug your appliances in, plug them directly into the generator, or at very least use a heavy duty extension cord that's rated for outdoors. As far as keeping warm, if you're going to use a fireplace, make sure you don't burn paper, because that's going to create sparks, going to create smoke. So use some dry wood, have an extinguisher close by, because if we are in winter conditions, a fire truck may not get there as quickly as it would normally. Have extra blankets and coats and things to really keep you warm. Close off any unneeded rooms. A lot of times it'll get really cold. Just close off those doors. Block everything from drafts, block your windows so you're not getting those drafts in. If you are going to use a portable heater, like we showed in that picture there, use something that is made for indoors. And then never, ever use a grill inside. We get that quite a bit. People think that they can just warm up. They bring the grill inside, and next thing you know, you got a bigger problem when you're asphyxiated. And definitely don't use your stove to heat up your home. And this is a little trick that I used to do with the kids when they were little too, is set up a tent in your house. What that does is it gives you a much smaller space in order to keep warm. So if it's really, really cold, you block off the other rooms, go ahead and pop a tent in there. You got a smaller space that you need to keep warm. A lot of people, especially we have an older population here in Island County. A lot of them have some special medical needs. So now is the time for you to prepare for those special needs, whether it's medication, whether it's getting batteries for your devices, things like that. If you have a chronic medical condition, talk to your doctor now, what we call blue sky days before the weather really gets bad. If you have medications, get them ahead of time. A lot of times you can't get it too far ahead, but if you get it just like a week ahead at a time, you can build up that supply for emergencies. Again, if you have medical devices, make sure you have backup batteries for it. If you take an oxygen, make sure that you have extra oxygen tanks and make sure that they're filled up. And then sometimes if you have a like a kidney condition or something like that, sometimes there's special emergency diets that you can utilize to keep the condition from getting worse if you can't get treatment every day. So definitely talk to your doctor about that. So the best bet if the roads are bad is just don't go out on the roads. I think a lot of times we overestimate what our ability is to drive in a road as demonstrated from this picture up here. So if you absolutely don't have to go out, then don't. But sometimes we just have to go out or we want to test the roads. So if you do, make sure you have an emergency kit in your car. And I think we provided you a handout from WashDOT, a really good one that's got a couple different things with that on what to put in your car. So have your little bits of snack and water, have warm clothes, have your jumper cables, have backup batteries, things like that. If you do get trapped in your car and you don't see rescue coming anytime soon, then what you can do is put something brightly colored on your antenna. If it's not snowing out, you can pop your hood. That way people know that you're in distress. Make sure your emergency kit is somewhere where you can access it. And then stay warm, wrap your body in clothes, blankets, try to stay awake so you don't fall asleep and end up freezing. If you're in there for a long period of time, you want to keep yourself moving too, because that circulation is going to help keep you warm. So move your hands, move your legs to keep warm. This is particularly important if you're doing any kind of mountain driving, because it might be even longer before you get rescued from there. If you are going to run the heater in the car, only do it for about 10 minutes at a time. Make sure you crack your window a little bit so you don't, so you have good ventilation there, and make sure your exhaust pipe is uncovered as well. This is also a good time if you're traveling with somebody, just huddle together, share that body warmth. If you're not a cuddler, now might be the time for you to, you know, become a cuddler. And then definitely don't eat the snow, because that's just going to lower your core body temperature and it's going to make it even colder than what you started with. So that is kind of the down and dirty of winter preparedness there. Hopefully we're just going to have, you know, beautiful snowflakes and, you know, nice conditions. I'm not really going to hold my breath about that. But with that, I'm here to answer any questions you might have. All the materials I provided you, by the way, are on our website, plus a lot more. We kind of gave you the...
So this WashDOT information is on our website?
It's on our website, yeah. So we try to give people a one-stop shop for information. So we'll pull stuff from our infrastructure systems and put them there.
Okay, good.
Hello, I like your little checklist.
Yeah.
We try to make it real simple, so... Yeah.
Okay, thank you so much, Eric.
Are we good? My pleasure.
Okay, we're going to the Board of Health impact report draft.
All right, so our communications team with Blueprint and Melissa, as well as our assessment team, have been working on, and I should actually just say our entire public health team has been working on bringing together different metrics that show impact of our services over time. Sean shared a presentation the time before last Board of Health, the snapshot of our impact through numbers. And mm-hmm. So we really wanted to create a visually appealing impact report that could be shared out with our public for the work that we've been doing in the last year. So I really just wanted to bring it to the Board of Health as a draft and kind of walk through it. And we don't have to come up with any decisions now, but something that we would really appreciate if you all have feedback or things we're missing, you're more than welcome to, we can talk about that now or share it via email or at the next meeting. I just wanted to share my screen real quick and we can scroll through that real fast, but just to show what we've been working on. And Just for context, when it is in its final version, the pictures will be higher quality. This is just the quality for being able to transfer it via email and such. But starts off with some images. It's very image heavy. We tried to focus a lot just based off of feedback from our community health assessment, and many of the things and materials that Blueprint have been producing have been very visually appealing. So we just wanted to keep up with that. Start off with an introduction into how this year has gone, and we focused the year on from June 23 to June 24. And if we get into kind of the routine of doing these, we can definitely get them out sooner.
So you say routine, what does that mean?
I think as we start to refine the metrics that we want to continue to evaluate or keep track of as public health department, going back to our priorities and really just fleshing that out, we could get into the routine of doing this, at least a larger report every year, internally and with the Board of Health or whomever the audience may be. Like quarterly updates would be really nice. I've seen that be really successful. And then our team across our divisions have been really interested in having just routine check-ins on not just our financial, how we're doing financially in each of our programs, but also just our impact and measuring that over time. So Human Services has been a great example of the work that, for Linda, with Gelada made a huge difference in being able, Gelada is our case management software system for folks who are not aware. And so that's been able to produce real-time information for our staff meetings and just for leadership and Human Services to track our reach as well as our quality of services and things of that nature. So as we move towards more of that approach through Gelada and SmartGov and all of these tools that we have at our disposal, we'll be able to produce information a little bit more quickly. Yeah. We really wanted to highlight a lot of our priorities that were set out in the strategic vision that was created this year. So we tried to align a lot of the work that's reflected in this report based off of those. We wanted to also make it a little bit personal and bringing some key remarks from each of our division leaders to highlight our successes and celebrate the work that our teams have been doing. And then in each of the key remarks, there's also a snapshot of plans for 2025, just to get folks excited about what's to come. Scroll back past the key remarks. This is a piece we're still working on with the organizational chart, if that's valuable for folks in our community or if it would be more valuable for folks in our community to see just the breadth of services we provide. I don't know if the board has any input on that, if they think there's no names on our org chart, but kind of gives a visual representation just how much staff power is going into the work that we do.
So you mentioned Human Services a moment ago and Gelada. Mm-hmm. How do they, I'm still confused about how they are reflected in this in any way.
That's a great question. This is mostly for public health right now, but we are more than happy to work with Human Services to create one for Human Services as well. The connection with Gelada I was thinking of that I didn't reflect verbally was with our community health team. We have two services programs that we provide in community health that we're going to be onboarding into Gelada. So we're trying to utilize the services that we have or the resources that we have in order to show impact just as Human Services is able to now. Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about this report?
Good. Yep, and then we just go through each of the priorities set up in our strategic vision. And then some of the metrics that we've collected from across our teams that reflect the work that we've been doing to achieve those priorities or uphold them.
Okay.
I'm not going to keep scrolling through the whole thing, but.
Well, my packet, maybe yours is different. Ron, my packet ends with the org chart.
Oh, gotcha.
So I got all kinds of data.
You got all sorts of things from yours?
I got priority 1, 2, 3.
Oh, okay, you got lots of priorities. Okay.
I'm happy to send this to you, sure. Commissioner.
Well, is it online? I mean, is it in the packet that's posted?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. It's okay. If it's in the packet that's posted, that's fine. And that's where people will see the data.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a draft. When are you hoping to finalize and put it out?
I think it's in a really good place to finalize it soon. I really wanted to get it in front of the Board of Health. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps our next meeting is in December. Maybe we could bring it back as the polished, and then just if there needs to be a vote on it or just a thumbs up from across the board would be awesome. And then we'll feel confident about getting that out to the community.
That sounds good, Taylor.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Looks good. Okay. And then we have just a general discussion on our training, Board of Health training update.
Yeah, I feel like more folks are here, that would be great too. But I'm happy to share a little bit of the Board of Health training reflections that I had. If mm-hmm. Commissioner, you have any too. I found it really useful and informative. I think there are a lot of tools and resources that we gather during that training that we can bring back to the Board of Health.
Mm-hmm.
And really just kind of identified areas where, in my opinion, we could really dig into more as a board and thinking about our impact. It's also timely because of, starting up a new year soon, we can really think about how we want to operate and what we really want to prioritize as a board.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I also really liked the exercises, which I know you too, Commissioner, appreciated the opportunity just to sit with a few staff members, plus our Commissioner Bacon was there and Mayor Oak Harbor Mayor was there too. Do you have anything you would like to add, Commissioner?
Yeah, it was real worthwhile. We at the one exercise, staff and the mayor and I we talked about the I forgot the Island Senior Resources issue, where they were not going to be able to deliver meals, hot meals on Fridays anymore. That came up with the Board of Island County Commissioners a few weeks ago. And we talked about this, that is an issue, and how do we kind of resolve that? And we learned in that conversation that the mayor and ISR had never connected with one another. And I think that was really valuable for the mayor of Oak Harbor to learn about that. We have so many clients of that program up in Oak Harbor, and their receipt of hot meal Fridays was in jeopardy. So it was just for us as a county, it was a real valuable conversation. And,
mm-hmm.
I thought the whole thing was really, really well done. I was very happy that I went. Melissa, did you have any thoughts?
Just exactly what you said. Opportunity for people to discuss some of the issues on the island.
Yeah, it was great. It's great.
Yeah.
So if you ever get a chance to go to the Board of Health training, it was really well worthwhile.
You let me know when it is.
Okay. And so public health updates, Taylor, is Dr. Librand on? I haven't seen him.
I don't think so today, but we do have a update from our team for a caravan event that occurred. I'm just bringing up the last week, and I have the updates just from Paul Shimada. He really has been spearheading the work with coordinating with Caravan, providing Caravan comes from the Department of Health to provide vaccinations in a mobile setting for folks who've signed up to receive them. And we had a really great turnout for the South Woodby Caravan. And I just wanted to highlight the success of that as also a need that we see in our community based off the community health assessment results. So some preliminary numbers that Paul shared with us was South Woodby, the caravan event was at South Woodby High School, and there were 227 vaccinations for 123 patients who showed up for that event. 71 were adults and 52 of them were children. So just speaking to the need, and Paul really saw that as an opportunity to bring Caravan back. So that's the plan for November, is to have another Caravan event to reach out to the folks who may not have accessed those services when we had them last time. So I'm just really excited about this work. I feel like it's meeting a need in our community. And so I just wanted to give a second to congratulate our team on that effort.
Well, congratulations. And I assume you're going to advertise the heck out of it on your social media.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else, Taylor?
I think we're okay at the moment. Yeah.
He's not here. Okay. Yes. And thank you. So the cancellation of the November 19th Board of Health regular session due to quorum issues there. Again, we won't have quorum. So the next regular session of the Island County Board of Health is going to be held on December 17th, 2024. Did you have anything else?
No.
Nope. All righty then. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you everybody for attending. Appreciate it.